sector and adult protected.
BCFM. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Devon-based British Constitution Group monetary reform campaigner Justin Walker and me, Tony Gosling. Shamima Begum wants to come back to the UK after supporting ISIS in Syria. But who was it that groomed her online and lured her out there and paid for her to get across Turkey down and across the Syrian border? Why have hundreds of fighters already returned to the UK without being questioned? And the BBC demonising Russia again. Khodorkovsky, the oligarch, is sponsoring an anti-Putin group in Russia. But that fact goes unreported by the BBC. So we take a closer look at Lloyds Bank's so-called business support unit here in Bristol, based in the old Bank of England Bristol office on the edge of Castle Park. Avon and Somerset police have come under intense criticism for not properly investigating evidence of alleged fraud at the Lloyds BSU. Their bait and switch technique allegedly has been pushing borrowers into toxic debt they can never repay. But it's not just Avon and Somerset police who are accused of not investigating Lloyds Bank. The Police and Crime Panel, which is mostly made up of councillors in the force area, are now investigating Police Commissioner Sue Mount-Stevens for not pulling the Chief Constable up over the detectives who can't find any fraud despite this alleged evidence. We hear from one Lloyds Bank victim who used to advise the Home Office on property fraud, Trevor Mealham. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon this week on Tuesday. The post-Brexit crisis. Edward Horgan is a former major in the Irish Army turned to a plane spotter. He's documenting what he calls illegal troop flights, which use Shannon Airport as a stop-off point between the United States and the Middle East. Plus, yes, the post-Brexit crisis. I get grilled too. If we leave the EU on the 29th of March, could we face a double whammy of a Middle East war between Iran and Israel, as well as a euro-dollar collapse? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But we start with going back to speak to Justin, and I do feel like I'm sort of ploughing my own furrow here on this Shamima Begum story. But one of the things I dug out, Justin, was that these three girls that were lured from Bethnal Green online onto a flight to Istanbul and then shepherded through Turkey down into Syria to join ISIS were actually taken there, according to the Turkish authorities who arrested the guy that did it, allegedly, they were taken there by Canadian intelligence. And so, in other words, Canadian taxpayers were paying to groom London school children, 15 and 16 years old, online in order for them to join ISIS. Now, does this come as any surprise to you?
Well, you and I, Tony, we know that the whole war on terror is suspect. From the events of 9/11, which, you know, we can drive a coach and horses through the official narrative of 9/11. The real people behind the whole war on terror, everything that's happened in Syria, Iraq, Libya, everywhere you look, we can pretty well point to the same group or the mindset that we're up against. And I'm going to repeat myself. This is the mindset that also controls the world's money. We are talking about barely 1%. In fact, it's hardly that at all. We're talking about no more than 2,000 or 3,000 people in the world who have the power, because they control the money, they have the power to be able to literally create wars, terror, or anything they like to do through bogus agencies, intelligence agencies, who we think are working for us, but in fact, many cases, they're working for this tiny elite this mindset that we're up against.
Now, hang on, though, because that surely here what you've really got is a system by which, you know, you can, I mean, certainly yes, it could create wars and things like that, but surely the press would expose these people if they really existed.
If we really genuinely had a free press. I mean, the BBC at the moment, well, you're probably aware we have an organisation called UK Column, which has its own, three times a week they put out an hour show, and they're taking apart what's going on. And if you listen to Vanessa Bealey, who was actually out in Syria, and, you know, her reports about the fact the White Helmets were actually terrorists, the White Helmets were not actually... you know, they were not benevolent and helping people. They were absolutely, you know, working as part of the terror, the whole thing. Now, you know, take the Syrian president Assad himself. Is he the monster that people make him out to be? Well, again, Vanessa's met him, and other people have. And to me, he is not the monster. But the BBC will not have. They have an agenda, and as far as they're concerned, he is an appalling individual, and the whole Syrian government has to be overthrown, and they are backing effectively what are terrorists. I mean, the BBC cannot be believed as they used to be.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's also fascinating to see that just yesterday the Russians tweeted, and it wasn't just the Russians tweeting this, there are a lot of people who have been circulating this online on social media, no mention of it whatsoever by the BBC, but a BBC producer has said the footage of the alleged gas attack victims in Syria, which sparked 57 cruise missile reprisal, was all staged. A Syria producer, Riam Dalab, has said on Twitter that the news footage of people being treated after the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma was using actors.
Yeah, absolutely right. It is unravelling. Everything.
So why isn't that the main news of the day? I mean, surely that's absolutely scandalous, the idea that you're actually trying to start a war, effectively, using fake BBC footage.
Yeah, well, that's a very, very good question. And, again, you've got to look at the mindset, how they control all the mainstream media, the newspapers, everywhere you go. I personally only watch the BBC now, the news, to see what they're not telling us and to actually try and see the picture. I mean, where do I start? There are just so many issues. I mean, they will not touch the Bradbury pound. They won't touch money creation and money supply. Everything that we are involved in at the British Constitution Group and the New Chartist movement, the great, you know, Magna Carta, you know, trying to restore our sovereign rights, we've written to the BBC, we've got nothing back whatsoever. They don't want to know.
Anyway, right? Before we get off the subject of Shamima Begum, this young 15-year-old who was lured over to Turkey and then down into Syria, and who has just been interviewed, let's have a listen to what she had to say now, because it's, you know, it's sort of quite useful, I think, to hear exactly where she's coming from now. She's saying she wants to come back to the UK.
After my two kids died, I'm really overprotective because of this baby. I'm scared that this baby's going to get sick in this camp. That's why I really want to get back to Britain, because I know it will be taken care of. Really, it came as a shock. It just came out of nowhere. It was so hard. You have to remember that these people, their beliefs are that you kill the non-Muslim, but you treat the Muslims, you know, good.
You said you didn't regret coming to be part of the caliphate.
Well, I don't regret it.
But on the other hand,
when I came and I saw that there was there's like underground oppression and all this happening, came as a shock to me. Like, this is actually happening.
Well, so in a way, she's saying she does regret it in a way, isn't she? So that's what she seems to be saying there. But also, I think we've just lost Justin on the line there. So that is pretty shocking, really, to see that. I think that there's so many aspects of this story. I did a report on it back in 2016. I did a report on which went on to Redress Online. There's all sorts of aspects of this that I'm hoping to speak to Justin about just then, but he's now disappeared. I have to try and get him back. And while I'm doing that, let's have a listen to related story, which is slightly related, which is also about the BBC. This one is about it was a report which was on the BBC World Service this week, And it's about a woman called Anastasia Shevchenko. Now, she has been arrested in Russia for running what is the Russian authorities say is a subversive campaign which is funded from abroad. Although the BBC don't really explain that, and they certainly don't mention the oligarch Khodorkovsky, who is based in Switzerland now. And he was in prison for 10 years in Russia for stealing massive amounts of state assets with from the Yukos oil firm. And he is the backer of the Open Russia movement, which Anastasia Shevchenko was part of. So if there is some financial whiz kid from abroad who is financing an organisation which is trying to subvert the Russian government, I would have thought it was fairly normal that such a person should be, first of all, dissuaded from joining that, and then if they persist, then they would probably face some kind of sanction. Not necessarily arrest, but you can't have foreign governments paying for people to undermine your own government. And it's quite understandable in many ways that the Russians have done this. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the BBC report on this arrest of this woman and detention of this woman, Anastasia Shevchenko, who's part of the Open Russia movement, which they don't actually mention in the report at all, the name of the movement, and they certainly don't mention the fact that it's funded by Khodorkovsky from Switzerland.
Anastasia Shevchenko is facing up to 6 years in prison for her alleged links to an opposition group that's been banned in Russia as undesirable. The crimes of which it's accused include attending political debates and peaceful protests. Human rights groups have condemned the treatment of the activist. But public anger over her case has been growing too since the death of her daughter. Sarah Rainsford reports from Rostov in southern Russia.
These days, Anastasia Shevchenko is only allowed outside to go to court. That's where I found her, with a police escort just one step behind.
How are you feeling, Matthew?
I can't talk.
The ban on speaking is a condition of her house arrest. There is a good reason this Russian single mum looks tense. She's now facing 6 years in prison for her political activism. The hearing was Anastasia's appeal for release ahead of her trial. She's been charged with links to an opposition group based in Britain and outlawed here in Russia as undesirable. Right from the start, her case has been condemned by human rights groups as draconian. Then, 2 weeks ago, Anastasia's eldest daughter was taken seriously ill. She was only allowed to visit Alina in hospital hours before she died. So this was how she addressed her accuser.
I would ask Mr. Prosecutor not to display pointless cruelty to my family. You could have let me see my daughter and hug her. If I'd made it to the hospital a day earlier, I'd have been able to do that.
Anastasia's plight has struck a chord with many Russian women. Last weekend in Moscow, hundreds turned out in protest. They called this the March of Mother's Fury. Some carried stuffed toys in place of placards.
So there's the BBC's report there. No mention whatsoever of the Open Russia movement being funded by Mikhail Khodorkovsky. This does seem... Are you back there now, Justin?
Yeah, sorry, we seem to have got cut off.
That's okay.
Hear most of that, I'm afraid.
Okay, but, well, anyway, the point being that in... This just to cover this particular story is that the BBC are reporting the arrest, and there's a campaign going on in Russia of Anastasia Shevchenko. She's part of something called the Open Russia Movement, and the BBC didn't actually say she was part of the Open Russia Movement, although I think they do on the internet version, and they certainly don't mention that this is being funded by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who of course is a billionaire who's now based in Switzerland, who made most of his money as a Russian oligarch through getting hold of the Yukos oil firm for something like 2 or 3% of its real value. So what do you this is just one example, but what do you make of the BBC and other media's anti-Russian propaganda?
Well, I'm keeping an open mind on what's happening in Russia at the moment, because I'm hearing rumours that Putin is considering declaring war on his central bank, which is obviously as part of the Bank for International Settlements, and he may do what John F. Kennedy did with his executive order 11110, when he got the Treasury, the U.S. Treasury, to create basically dollars based on their silver gilt stocks. And many believe that that was probably a good reason why he was assassinated, because he was going against the Federal Reserve and the central banking system. Now, if Putin does this, and I've been told it could be gold-backed or it could be silver-backed, and he starts to create a treasury ruble rather than being involved too much with the central banking system, that could be very interesting indeed.
Well, it's already very interesting, I think, because a lot of people around the world are starting to invest in Russia because they don't have this whole thing of zero interest rates, which most of the Western world has, and in fact in Switzerland even negative interest rates. So you put £1,000 in the bank, you will find there's only 990 left, the next year, because you've got you don't get any interest in the banks anymore in Switzerland. And in Russia, they're running apparently round about something like 7 or 8% interest. So a lot of people are actually putting their money into Russian banks in the knowledge that there'll be a real return.
Yeah, well, at the moment, as I said, I'm keeping my options open as regards Russia. I mean, Putin doesn't strike me as a real democrat. I mean, he probably is an oligarch, but on the other hand, what is the alternative? And you mentioned that gentleman living in Switzerland, and I hardly view him as a benevolent alternative. So, and the Russian people, certainly when you look at Russia today compared to what Russia was like 30 years ago, I would say they're in a pretty good place at the moment, and they're full of self-confidence, and I'm keeping an open mind on that. But going back to the BBC, we basically in the New Chartists, we're going to be starting a campaign probably in April and May, where we're going to have peaceful vigils outside the BBC in London and Manchester, and asking them for live televised debates so that their journalists, the BBC journalists, can debate with what we term the alternative media journalists. And let's discuss things like health issues, 9/11, money creation, all these issues where we know we are at odds with what the BBC are saying. So, you know, part of our charter surely is to get to the truth on things. So let's have a proper, open, you know, basically live debates on these issues where their journalists can put their point of view and debate with basically our journalists, like yourself, Tony, and people, you know, working UK Column and New Chartists, whoever. But the point is, bring these issues and let's see where the truth lies.
Well, look, before we get completely away from talking about Shamima Begum and the general war on terror, and particularly what's been going on with the Russians moving into Syria, I mean, there seems to be an attempt by the Americans to sort of claim that they have beaten ISIS, where I think most people are aware that it's actually the Syrian army and the Russians that have done that, not the Americans, is looking at this whole aspect. I mean, it's been this kind of, I would say, characterised as a kind of moral panic right across the media over the last day or so about should this woman be allowed to come back to Britain. Well, as far as I can see, she wasn't actually a fighter for Islamic State over in Syria. She was basically there to befriend the men who were the fighters and to be kind of a support worker of some kind. However you want to take that, but the question is, should she be allowed back to come back to Britain? There's this kind of lots of people getting very frenetic saying no, she shouldn't, and there was a bit of a discussion on BBC's Question Time about that last night, but the question really is, I mean, if she was taken over there, as it looks as if the Turkish evidence certainly says, by the Canadian intelligence, the other question here is that there are actually lots and lots of people since the demise of ISIS after the Russians arrived in Syria. Lots and lots of Brits have come back, and there's a fascinating Daily Mirror article, Justin, saying that only 14 out of 400 British ISIS fighters who've returned to the UK after fighting in Syria have actually been interviewed and jailed. Most of them have just been allowed to sort of fine, you know, just come back. So Why is it that suddenly one woman has hit the headlines for a whole day? Everyone seems to be talking about, oh, she shouldn't be allowed back. Well, there are so many that have been allowed back and apparently just been allowed to go back into normal society.
Well, you're absolutely right, Tony. Personally, I err on the side of compassion in the case of this lady, and I think she should be brought back to her family, and she's got to be deprogrammed, and she's got to be helped. So that's my basic thing. But when we talk about ISIS, what was ISIS, who created it, who created Al-Qaeda, who created the Mujahideen, I'm sorry, you know, again, because we know we have this mindset in the world that does not hold our best interests at heart and are basically seeking what can only be described as a global future of basically like a feudal system of enslavement for all of us, as I said, because they control the money, they control all aspects of the governance, and in fact they're trying to get about some sort of, we've got Agenda 2130, which is at the UN. This is about putting people into smart cities and all sorts of stuff.
Well, look, let me just drag you back, I'm afraid, to talk about the these returning fighters from Syria. This is an article from the 9th of October 2016, Stephen Jones, assistant editor at the Daily Mirror. Only 14 of 400 British ISIS fighters who returned to the UK after fighting in Syria have been jailed, he says. The shock figure was admitted by the government is much lower than the ministers had previously claimed. So it means that almost 400 jihadis trained in Syria and Iraq are at large on Britain's streets. And that was reported in turn by the Mail on Sunday back in 2016. But there's also another article from the Telegraph. More than 425 of the 850 Britons who left to join Islamic State the last 5 years have returned. Only fewer in Turkey's 900 returnees, Tunisia's 800. So what they're saying in the Telegraph is more British ISIL fighters have returned home than to any other Western country. And that was being reported in 2017, a year after the previous article. So we seem to have a lot of these people running around who have probably had contact with British intelligence of one sort or another. Certainly they know who they are. What's bothering me most about this, Justin, is that these people will obviously be a bit nervous that they may be arrested, they may be jailed, and so they make perfect recruits for intelligence services to do dirty tricks of various sorts.
Well, I am very worried indeed. We've got the rise of Tommy Robinson, who is clearly states he's a Zionist and everything else. You've got the far right getting animated about the Muslim problem and all this stuff. And I fear, what I fear most is violence and unrest and chaos on the streets. And because this gives the elite the absolute excuse to bring in Orwellian control over all of us, and we can kiss goodbye to those things we hold so dear, the Great Charter, habeas corpus, trial by jury, all this. Because we're already seeing trial by jury is taking second place now. We're getting more and more judges overseeing the courts with no juries.
Well, let me just also intervene again. Sorry to keep interrupting you, but I mean, looking at these, most of these terrorist cases, particularly the 7/7 London bombings case, this was done, it wasn't a public inquiry, it should have been a public inquiry. It was done as a series of inquests, as if these deaths had all been independent, the 52 or so people who died that day. And also, they made sure that there was no jury there as well. They dismissed there was no jury at all.
It is very worrying, Tony. I mean, this is the real reason why we're involved as New Chartists. We're trying to keep what is rightfully ours. We are all sovereign human beings, and we are entitled to a trial by jury, common law constitution. That is, we are a common law country. But as all part of this European integration, we are losing our most basic...
Well, look, anyway, you mentioned Tommy Robinson there very appositely, because this week there's some fascinating footage released of Tommy Robinson doing some kind of selfie, looking as if he was high on something, maybe beginning with the letter C. I'm not entirely sure, but it certainly looked like that. And so let's have a little listen to a clip now. This is Tommy Robinson ranting away as he talks about how easy it is for him him to score drugs, and how he would seize the whole conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis rather like the conflict between Rangers and Celtic in Glasgow, and he explains who he would fight for. So let's have a listen to Tommy Robinson now.
Moreover, because me coming through, and this is what me and I'm going to do. I'm going to punch you in the head, I kick you in the face, because I am the king of the whole Islam race. No matter where I've gone in the world, I score. I'll show you tonight. As soon as we get in this pub, I'm going to record it for you. I've gone to Qatar, bruv. I've gone to Doha. The school gear of the sesh while they're all praying. I've gone everywhere, mate. Everywhere. Every city I've gone to. When we went to Germany for the World Cup, I was like, see you later, lads. Where are you going? I'm going to find out. And then that's it. We're on.
So I had to ring Benjamin Netem Palestine. I can't remember his name. And then I got my Zionist card out, which said, I am a Zionist. And then I bought everything. Shalom. Harry, listen, let me tell you something. Yeah? If there was a war tomorrow, which there will be, because I'll probably start at the end of the session, if there was a war and it kicked off, I would be there on the front line fighting for Israel. Do you know why? Why not? Why not? It's like Celtic. I had some one of my mates' dad's come up to me earlier talking about Celtic. Like, oh yeah, but you're Celtic Rangers. You know what I mean? Palestine. Palestine. Why would you support Palestine?
Well, that's Tommy Robinson there characterising the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis in the occupied territories as a game of football between Glasgow, Celtic and Rangers.
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, I worry about Tommy Robinson, or that's not even his real name. I think he's a Pied Piper. I think he's leading a lot of people astray. This whole Zionist business, I just feel, I mean, look what's happening in the Labour Party at the moment, because as soon as you start to question Israel, Zionism, and what they're up to, and you don't, you know, as I said, I always say to people, feed into any search engine Jews against Zionism or Jews against Israel. I'm working with Jewish people who are concerned about Zionism, who are concerned about Israel. And I just find it very alarming that all our political parties have friends of Israel, friends of, you know, we don't have friends of Russia in groups and friends of France or friends of Japan. But friends of Israel, that's allowed. And it doesn't matter if it's UKIP, Lib Dems, Conservative, Labour, they've all got their friends of Israel. Well, I'm sorry, you know, our MPs should be serving our country. They should be serving our interests. And they should be working to make this world a safer, peaceful, and environment, you know, restore and protect the environment of the world. That's what our MPs should be doing, not taking sides of just one country. So I just wonder what on earth is going on with all this anti-Semitic stuff. Because, you know, as soon as you start to question what Israel are up to, you're accused of being anti-Semitic. Well, I'm sorry, in which case I'm anti-Semitic. I just find it incredible, Tony.
What do you think's behind it then?
Well, I'm going to go back to that mindset that we know doesn't like the human race. Now, in our research over the last 6 months, we've had some very, very good, well-researched people tell us to look up the Sabbatean Frankists. That's Sabbatean, Sabbatean, and then Frankist. Look them up, because these were a sect in the 17th century in Turkey, and they've infiltrated effectively the Catholic Church with the Jesuits, and they've infiltrated Islam, and they've infiltrated Judaism. Now, as I said, we're still on a steep learning curve with this. But we're starting to see this bloodline mindset, which really is creating, if you like, virtually all the problems that humanity is up against.
I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that there's actually only really a tiny number of people who have been, you know, throughout history creating a mess for everybody else. That, you know, with these people out of the way and honest people in charge, actually humanity could actually start to flourish, Justin.
Let me just give you a quick example, In 1999, I was a government guest to Iran. I went out to the state of Iran. And, of course, I went there with some trepidation because I thought, my God, this is a country which is, you know, creating wars. They've just had their war against Iraq and, you know, all the rest of it. And I was worried because I believed the BBC in those days. When I got there, I was received by ordinary people in the street. I had a minder. I had a government minder. She was an 18-year-old girl student who just wanted to know all about Britain, what it was like to live in Britain, etc. I met the president, Khatami, and the vice president. We even had a fish and chip supper at the English Club in Tehran. You couldn't make this stuff up. And it was absolutely wonderful. And I was taken to ordinary people, and we're taken out to families, and it was just a lovely country. Totally different to what we were led to believe. So I genuinely do believe that if we can just expose and take down this mindset who controls the world's money, who effectively are trying to create super states. This is what this European super state is all about. We don't want a super state. We just want countries, sovereign countries, working together peacefully, in harmony, and most importantly, all protecting the environment of our planet so we can hand over to...
But surely the EU is just there for to facilitate trade and business.
I wish that was just the case. If it went back to the original common market before it morphed into this super state, you do know our armed services are being effectively handed over to Europe. I mean, the UK column and others are heading the charge on this to try and wake people up to the fact that our armed services will be beholden to the European Union at the end of this year.
Well, hopefully not after the 29th of March. Anyhow, look, I mean, you mentioned Iran there. Very little coverage of it, but there was a horrific attack in Iran this week. Iran's President Rouhani vows punishment for the Sistan-Baluchistan attack. 3 days of mourning are declared to honour 27 dead Revolutionary Guard members as Iran links the deadly attack to US action. Earlier, the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said it is no coincidence that his country was hit on the same day that the US held a summit in Poland, which is seen as aimed at countering Iran.
Yeah. Well, I'm not obviously an expert on that, exactly what's going on, but I would say that qui bono, who benefits? Always ask that question. Always question everything. Qui bono, who benefits from something that happens?
Well, also, it's worth remembering that this week is the 40th anniversary of the 1979 Iranian Revolution. So this meeting in Poland is scheduled to coincide with that. The idea is to try and get regime change in Iran, but also, of course, at the same time, an attack on the Revolutionary Guard. I mean, it would really be like exploding a bomb in Horse Guards parade and killing 27 or 30 guardsmen or whatever who were guarding the Whitehall.
Yeah, I know. As I said, we've got intelligence services out of control. And within those intelligence services, I think there's a degree of, there are elements, probably the majority, who are genuine patriots who think they believe they're serving their country and they believe they're doing what's right. But there is a minority who are very much there, basically receiving their instructions from the deep state.
And if anyone steps out of line, like Dr. David Kelly did in the run-up to the 2003 illegal Iraq war, the idea, I suppose, is that it's very clear what will happen to them. Also this week, Justin, let's just run through some international news stories. We'll stick with the Middle East, I suppose. Benjamin Netanyahu has fired back at Iran. I mean, I don't know if that's literally, but anyway, he says, attack Tel Aviv and it will be the last anniversary you ever celebrate. At a rally celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, a senior Iranian commander threatened to raise Tel Aviv to the ground if the US attacks them. So they're making it very clear in Iran, if the US attacks Iran, that they will hit Tel Aviv.
Yeah, as I said, the Middle East politics, I simply say, you know that Israel is wanting the Greater Israel project, that it exists. We know that there's something to do with the temple, the mount. I'm not a great expert on this,
Well, they want to create the third temple, don't they, on the Temple Mount. The only thing, of course, here, there could be some kind of compromise between the Israeli government or between the third temple group, as they're called, that want to create this temple on Temple Mount. They've got this massive problem in that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is one of the oldest and the most revered mosques in the whole of Islam, is right smack bang in the middle of Temple Mount. So if they want to rebuild the third temple, they'll have to knock down that mosque. But there could be some kind of compromise, because there is another mosque there called the Dome of the Rock, which is on the side, which wouldn't have to be demolished. So I just, thing is, Justin, I can't see the Iranians and the Israelis, I can't really see Islamic representatives and Zionist representatives getting together on this, demolition of something like the Al-Aqsa Mosque could spark a religious war.
No, I know. And the controllers, who are the real controllers in the world, know damn well what they're doing. I just want, you know, I mean, religion is a wonderful thing for some people. But on the other hand, there's so much poison in the religion, it can start wars.
Well, that's what you're also suggesting there, is that these major faiths have also got these kind of parasitic organisations on the side of them.
Yeah, this is exactly what's happened. And, you know, the faiths, I mean, I once experienced, it was back in the 1970s now, I was in Assisi, and all the faiths are represented to discuss the environment and discuss protection of the environment. This is the early days when Jacques Cousteau was talking about it, and it was a wonderful experience. You had Muslims, you had Hindus, you had Buddhists, you had Christians, you had everyone. Total harmony. So something is wrong with the religions, and it has to be this Sabbatean Frankists. We have got this satanic, evil side to the religions that have somehow latched themselves on. And I think people need to do their research. They need to really start asking questions about this. We are, as I said, we the research has only just begun on this, to really try and find out what on earth is going on.
Well, let me just suggest something. Maybe the nihilists are getting involved, because these people will say anything and do anything to get what they want, including putting on the vestments of a Catholic cardinal or an archbishop of the Church of England or anything. And they absolutely have no morals whatsoever.
Yeah, and the other thing we haven't really—I touched upon it with Ted Heath—but the other thing, I'm part of a thing called the International Tribunal on Natural Justice, and we had a hearing in London last year. And you can see them. You go on ITNJ and just feed in ITNJ hearing on child trafficking. You will realise that millions of children are suffering appalling acts, ranging from murder right through to obviously paedophilia and everything else, and outright slavery. This is the thing that really has motivated me now, that we've really got to get things moving.
Well, one of the big flashpoints around the world, of course, is between India and Pakistan, both nuclear-armed powers. Yeah. And just yesterday we saw a horrific attack there in Kashmir. 44 Indian soldiers were killed. Now, obviously, the Indians, immediately the knee-jerk reaction is to point the finger at Pakistan, which they've done. But that isn't necessarily the case, Justin, is it? There are also these kind of third actors. I mean, we've seen this in, you know, the Ian Fleming's novels, where there are other actors that just simply want to get countries fighting each other, and then they can actually make a profit out of it.
And of course, as I say, bankers make huge profits out of wars. I mean, it's like, as you, we both know, because we both studied the First World War and the Second World War, the real history to the First and Second World War is yet to be told. How it came about, who funded it, who really engineered. I mean, the First World War, we all believe it was, you know, the sort of the inbred relations of Victoria all falling out, and you had generals wanting to try out their new weaponry and everything else. No, the bankers were maneuvering around the place. They were creating the problem. And just as you look with how the, as we mentioned, the Weimar Republic collapsing, but then look how Hitler suddenly managed to come onto the scenes. Who funded him? And interestingly, of course, that Hitler actually did use a form of bribery to suddenly start building autobahns.
Well, I'll tell you who funded Hitler. That was the Bank for International Settlements. That was certainly one of them that you mentioned earlier. Who the idea was to close them down at the Bretton Woods conference. But look, it's another story popped up this week. We'll try and rattle through them here on this show, Justin. And that is that Australia's Prime Minister's advisor says climate change is a UN-led ruse to establish a new world order. Tony Abbott's business advisor says global warming is a fallacy supported by the UN in order to create a new authoritarian world order under its control.
Right, well, I'm just going to have to give you a personal example of how I know that he's right. I mean, you know, as I say, I'm a green. I'm passionate about protecting the environment, the ecosystems and everything else. But because of my uncle, I met a chap called Aurelio Peche, who was the co-founder of the Club of Rome. And I had lunch with him and Thor Heyerdahl, the explorer. In fact, he actually offered me a job to come and work for him as one of his personal advisors. And he actually said, we are creating a global problem that will force people to accept global government. And that global problem that they were creating was man-made global warming, not climate change. Climate change has been going on for millions of years, but man-made global warming, this is the science that they were developing. Now, Piers Corbyn, Jeremy Corbyn's brother, he absolutely knows that it's bad science. I was privileged enough to know David Bellamy, and I can remember having a cup of coffee, and he just looked at me and said, Justin, this is all bad science, bad science.
Hang on, what's this? Doesn't sound like the BBC.
Outside the box is in. Virtue signalling and confirmation bias is out. In depth on dialect. Bristol's first podcast here on BCFM every Wednesday at noon.
Well, I can just ask listeners if they would like to go back to one of the dialect programmes from a couple of months ago where we had Joe House, who's the climate science lead, Dr. Joe House, up at Bristol University, having an hour, a ding-dong, with Piers Corbyn. And I'll just leave it. I'll put a link up to that show on our show page and see who you think did the best. Also, look, must talk a little bit more, I'm afraid, about European affairs because we've had this week, Justin, we've had the Catalonian MPs put on trial for sedition and for rebellion. At the same time, the Spanish government have found that they cannot get their budget through, and so they're going to have to call a general election in Spain.
Yeah, now the Catalonian thing, obviously the country is split on this. I'm actually a great fan of Leopold Kerr, the writings of Leopold Kerr, and he actually wrote a book called The Breakdown of Nations, where he said basically the smaller the sovereign nations, all working in harmony, you don't have major problems, you don't have major wars. I can sympathise with the people of Catalonia, but the thing is this, the trial that those people accused of rebellion are now having to sit through is a kangaroo court. This is not a trial of randomly selected people to hear the argument in court and for the jury to be the judge to make the decision whether they are guilty or not. They are having to sit before an appointed panel of judges, a politically appointed judges. And this is typical of Roman civil law, which is prevalent in Europe and which is creeping into our country. So I feel a sort of empathy with the people of Catalonia. If they genuinely want, if there's a sizable majority, two-thirds majority is the safe number you should go for if you're making major constitutional changes. But I do actually feel sorry for the people of Catalonia at the moment with what's going on. And I think the Spanish government, well, they've got to realise that if they show compassion and they try and meet, they may be able to defuse the situation.
But they're not doing that. Basically, they're going for a general election instead. So we'll see what happens there. Also, on Italy, Guy Verhofstadt tweeted this week. He said, I love Italy. It's the place where our European civilization was born. From being a staunch defender of Europe, it's now the country that is under pressure from Putin to prevent the European Union from being united against Maduro. It's very painful for me to see such political degeneration. Well, this is interesting in that he's saying that the Italians are the only people in Europe who are supporting Maduro over in Venezuela, and everyone else is united that this new right-wing guy that the Americans support should be running the country.
Yeah, and I would simply say sovereign national credit. Maduro could be creating debt-free, interest-free money for his people. I was actually quite an admirer of his predecessor. You know, I felt very
Hugo
sorry.
Chavez.
Yeah, Hugo Chavez. And I was very sorry when he died because I think he was genuinely a good man.
But what about this whole thing of accusing the Italians of kowtowing to Putin?
Yes, I mean, it's a joke. I mean, at least we have a government in Italy now which is not your straightforward left-right spectrum. You've got people who appear to be applying common sense and applying a rationale to what they're doing and saying. And if they can clearly see that what's happening in Venezuela is not right. And they've spoken out. So they've broken ranks, if you like, with the rest of the countries, which are all in line with the thinking of the 1%. So, yeah, I just say, as I said, Venezuela, I just hope to God it doesn't become a Vietnam.
It's also in South America. There's also Argentina to look at this week. In Al Jazeera reporting, tens of thousands have been marching against austerity in Argentina. Many Argentines, already struggling with inflation, have been hit harder as Macri cuts government spending. Basically, he's just been told what to do by the IMF.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the IMF is a public front to the people, BIS. As I said, everything is, all, I mean, you know, a government is not really a sovereign government over its people. And whilst you have this money creation and money supply system that is totally 100% corrupt and needs to go lock, stock and barrel, if you keep with that system, then your government will be controlled by the BIS and the people who control the BIS. Because the BIS is just a holding camp. I mean, basically, the governors of the top central banks go there to receive their instructions.
Well, Mark Carney, of course, is famously from there. He's from their policy committee and regulation committee that deregulated so much that we had a 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah. And as I said, there's a reset plan. We know that there's something being lined up for a collapse, where they can reset the... Because what they're trying to do is go for what we call a global electronic monetary system. They're trying to take cash out of the system. They're trying to make us into a cashless society, closing down high street banks and everything else. So the whole thing becomes banking, becomes digital. With all the Bitcoin and all these different weird and wonderful currencies, you'll find the central banking people now. I don't understand it. I'm going to be the first one to admit it's all beyond me. But blockchains and various other things. I'm told that there may be a way of creating a sort of Bradbury-type electronic system, which would be...
Well, that's just real speculation there. Anyway, let's wind up by having a listen to Ian Neal, who died last week. He's somebody I know you knew, Justin, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I'm very sorry to hear that.
So let's have a listen to what Ian said. And I asked him, first of all, about some of the... I mean, he was one of the original 9/11 truth campaigners back in just not long after the 2001 attacks. And he was himself as an engineer. He's worked in all sorts of third world countries, etc. So I was fascinated to hear, really, what he had to say about some of the major figures around the world who've come out and as not 9/11 truthers, saying we're not being told the truth about what really happened in the September the 11th attacks and demanding a proper investigation by the media too.
Well, first of all, it's normally ignored, but the story dies a death. But we need more of those, and we need the different campaigns who are calling for transparency and accountability in this country to come together and not be afraid to be... Well, yes, we are saying it's a conspiracy. We can't tell you exactly how it happened, so we don't necessarily have our own theory of the actual mechanics. Yeah, we also know, of course, that the media is intensely infiltrated by the intelligence services. And I do like that approach of trying to find people within the mainstream that come out and challenge things. So there's people like Ed Asner, the famous US actor, was very supportive of the 9/11 families and critical to that. Some of the family members like William Rodriguez have been over to this country and spoken, and his testimony is very powerful because there's an eyewitness there to the events of the day, and the official version cannot be true given what he experienced and his witness. So the other sort of Michael Meacher.
He's a Labour MP, actually up until fairly recently, one of the longest serving Labour cabinet ministers.
Yes, he was, yeah. But what happened as a result of that? Nobody responded to say, Michael...
What did Michael actually say?
He didn't... He basically said, I have my doubts about the... And then he lists all the elements of the official version, which he was struggling with. And if you go into the details of the intelligence and the defence failures and the nature of the tower collapses and so forth, you know, I share those questions. But the issue is that here's a UK MP...
He's also a member of the Shadow Cabinet. Yes. He's a former cabinet minister.
Highly respected.
Privy Councillor.
Yeah. But did anyone respond to his questions? No. In the media, amongst his colleagues and so forth. And maybe based on his experience back in, and I hesitate on the dates, but I'm pretty sure it's around 2008, about 10 years ago, 10 of us spent an hour in the House of Commons with Jeremy Corbyn going through all the evidence and case for that. Listened politely and acknowledged there were serious questions to answer and was supportive, but that didn't translate into action. It didn't translate into public statements. So, and there have been vague other statements which are supportive of 9/11 truth, but at the same time hasn't been carried forward into wider recognition. An example would be John Pilger, where he has voiced questions but hasn't taken his arguments further, and he doesn't make it in a high profile event. So you know, every time somebody comes out who's high profile, and it helps to spread the word, it helps to interest people, but equally it does tell you how fearful people are to step out of line with the elite. They especially in the media, they recognize the consequences of it.
What are the consequences?
Well, you won't work again, I think, is probably... you will just quietly get dropped. Or you won't get a belt crest. That would be my... We've so frequently approached broadcasters, newspapers, for the right of reply. Case in point was the BBC's conspiracy files. Completely didn't engage with us at all, just put out there... message of...
I mean, they did a programme, was it about 9/11, or was it one that went specifically about Building 7? I think they did.
Actually, four, as I believe. So there was the overview of 9/11, then there was the tower collapses, and related to that, they even did a particular programme trying to explain, but I still can't get my head around, how they managed to broadcast the fact that... the World Trade Center 7, the third tower to collapse on 9/11, a fact that I would wager the majority of the population of this country would still be unaware of, i.e. that the three towers collapsed rather than two towers collapsed on 9/11, because it's hardly ever been broadcast since. So anyway, the programme they did was trying to explain how Jane Stanley could manage to broadcast the fact that this building had collapsed 10 minutes before it actually did collapse. In other words, somebody had given them prior warning that this building was going to collapse.
Well, there was even a picture of the building still standing behind her as she announced it. This does suggest, doesn't it, that you've got...
Funny enough, Tony, guess what happened when she was doing that? Oh, we just lost the satellite feed there, Tony. Oh, we'll be back to you in a second. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, whatever. Yeah,
so it does suggest that some of these events, the news people aren't really news people. They're more like theatrics following a script.
Yeah, stenographers and... okay, I suppose... And we should reflect on how the media's become more controlled just since 9/11. I can remember times when the BBC wasn't always as controlled as it now is. At least they would broadcast things that you won't see the light of day of now. But, yes, it's remarkable. If people are interested on trying to look at the wider picture, I would recommend a website that's called wanttoknow.info. Just put want to know in. The reason I like this website is that it's got various sectors that it looks at, providing evidence that this conspiracy, the New World Order, if you like, or the global elite, infiltrates all these different areas, the military, the media, health, so many different aspects, money creation and supply. Right, but the reason why this website is of interest is the evidence they use is all drawn from mainstream media sources. So you can check out, this is mainstream broadcasters basically saying, yes, there is. Oh, child abuse was the other one. Some fantastic documentaries on there. But the point I'm just trying to, you know, that site is a very good starting point, because you wouldn't be shy of showing that to your relatives and so forth.
It seems to me that what you're saying is that the mainstream media is telling us the truth. It's just that it hasn't got the bigger picture.
Yeah. And as PNAC shows, the various deliberations we've had about New World Order and so forth, hey, they tell us what they're doing themselves. You know, they tell us their plans. It's just nobody takes any interest.
So. The X-Files, the truth is out there.
Yes. Indeed so.
Why do you think that you have still been working? I mean, this is, well, we're talking about 15 years after the beginning of the UK 9/11 truth campaign. Why do you think you're still at it?
I guess the thing which is brings me back to it is recognising the connection between 9/11 and events that are happening today. And so, well, let's just take the last year. So you've got the child abuse inquiry and all the questions around that. And then you've got the war in Syria and the, you know, we're going to war now, not on, fanciful presentations to the UN, but on YouTube videos, you know. And then we don't even bother going any further in terms of proof. We just drop some bombs. We go and drop some cruise missiles on a chemical weapons factory. Go figure that one. You know, we're trying to blow up an alleged chemical weapons factory. So that, you know, that should be making everybody scream, what the heck is going on here? Same with Duma, given the evidence which has come out about that, which discredits the White Helmet's testimony from Robert Fisk and from other independent reporters on the ground and people who witnessed it, that there were no chemical weapons used. But I am seeing that these connections all the time between the wars of today and the cover-ups of today and with 9/11. So I guess why I latch on to 9/11 is because its consequences are still reverberating with us today. And the body of evidence, okay, I've just mentioned Duma, and there's probably two or three reports or angles on the evidence which calls the official version into account. On 9/11, there must be 100 different aspects or angles, probably 500, you know? Each of them backed up with solid testimony and solid evidence that just cannot be explained away. I'll give you one brief example. In relation to World Trade Center 7, first of all, most people aren't aware of it, but how do we explain away the testimony of Barry Jennings? Maybe you're not familiar with him, but look him up. Okay. Sadly, he died 2 days before the NIST report, which was the official report into its collapse, many years in the making because it was so difficult to explain. He died 2 days before their inquiry came out. But his testimony was that he personally witnessed explosions within World Trade Center 7 before it collapsed. The other question marks relate to the nature of the iron spheres, which indicate explosives were were used in its collapse, but related to that, how do we possibly explain from fire-induced collapse the heat signature in the foundations of the towers, which were far in excess of the temperatures required to melt steel, far in excess of the temperatures reached in normal office fires?
So there's Ian Neal there speaking to me last June. Died last week, unfortunately, of brain tumour. Justin, I know you worked with him, I believe.
Yes. I'm very sad to hear that, because Ian, when we started the 9/11 truth movement in this country, he was the one who talked to me first, got me on board, And then when Ian Crane stood down as chair, I think Ian, myself and Annie Machon became co-chairs, and we carried on for a few more years before we handed the baton over to somebody else. I'm very sad. He was a nice chap, and as you heard there, he was summing up pretty well what tonight's programme's been about. I'm very sorry to hear about his death. Very sad.
Also, another person that died this week is Lyndon LaRouche. Let's have a listen to him. He's a much more controversial figure. He believed that the British were some kind of incredibly evil force that were trying to control the world. So let's have a clip of him now saying some of his controversial things about us.
The British Empire has always been, since its beginning, as a beginning, has been a satanic operation. It has been intrinsically satanic. And what's happened is the effect of that kind of culture and the fact that people try to get by satisfying the demands of that culture, that is the way in which many of people in the United States have lost their souls.
Well, that's Lyndon LaRouche, who died this week. And also, you heard just before that from Ian Neal. Anyway, thank you very much, Justin Walker. Also, thanks to Mike Davis and to Clive Stevens, councillors. Tonight, time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.